Literally from the North Shore presents Dean Hovey's book Whistling Sousa in 14 episodes. This is the final episode, 14.
She looked older, and I realized she wasn't wearing any makeup except for some subdued lipstick. "I'm so glad you're here," I said, giving her a hug that was returned without enthusiasm. "I'm not sure this is a good idea," she said, giving me a sad look, "but I have a new EpiPen in my pocket, and I thought I'd give it a try." She joined the band and selected a reed before tuning with the band. I noticed she kept careful control over her reed cases. John Carr leaned over and patted her on the arm. In return, he got a half-hearted smile. Abby Finch was giving me nervous glances after watching my sprint into the crowd. I gave her a reassuring smile and a thumbs up. She blushed and quickly looked away. I stepped to the podium and wrapped my director's baton on the edge, bringing the band to silence. I nodded to each of the band sections and got a nod in return, indicating everyone's readiness. I took the microphone and faced the crowd. "Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the Two Harbors City Band Year-End Concert. I'm Peter Rogers, and although I'm a relative newcomer to town, I've been offered the honor of filling in as the guest director. As most of you know, our final concert is always an all-March evening. Judging by the size of the crowd and the number of alumni members who've joined us, I'd say it's very popular. Without further delay, I'd like to introduce the Washington Post March by John Philip Sousa." I raised the baton, and the band members brought up their instruments. With the first downstroke, the band hit the opening note. I was immediately energized. We moved on to the Colonel Bogie March by Kenneth Alford, the traditional marching song, the British Grenadiers, and then back to Sousa with Semper Fidelis. The band played with flawless precision, and I was carried to a euphoric world of harmony. A fast 45 minutes later, we took a 10-minute intermission. I looked frantically for Jenny, but her chair was still empty. While scanning the crowd, I found a group of gray-headed attendees sitting near the corner of the park. I recognized many of the Whistling Pines residents chatting among themselves, along with a few other senior citizens. Wendy moved among them like a mother hen. I saw Jenny's mother, Barbara, who gave me a regal nod when our eyes met, which gave me a rush when I again realized that Jenny was still nowhere in sight with the piccolo. I checked with Sheila, who was sitting stonily in her chair next to John Carr, carefully holding her reed cases. "Are you doing okay?" I asked. John Carr leaned close and held Sheila's elbow. "We're fine," he replied, staying true to his promise to keep an eye on her. As he leaned, his coat slid aside, and I saw his holster, which gave me a feeling of confidence that he did have control of whatever situation might arise. We opened the second set with a song called the Viva Mexico March and cruised through three more numbers before I had another chance to look for Jenny. She wasn't in her chair, and my heart fell. We were down to the last three songs when I announced the triumphal march by Verdi. I flipped open the music and saw the bassoon solo and nodded to Sheila. She looked confident and took a deep breath. The song opened with the trumpet fanfare, and the rest of the band followed. I was again floating with the music and saw the bassoon solo approaching. Sheila stood and started her solo when a rim shot rang out. None were in the music. I glanced at the drummer, who was also looking around. I kept directing but glanced at the audience over my shoulder just as I heard a scream and saw a woman running toward the stage with a pistol. I realized the rim shot I'd heard was actually a gunshot. I looked quickly at Sheila, who looked shocked but was behind John Carr. His Glock pistol was out of its holster, and his body was between Sheila and the shooter. He edged her toward the stairs with the gun at his side. I looked around, and the world seemed to be in slow motion. The crowd was in chaos, with screams, crying, and yelling as people scrambled from their chairs. To my great relief, I saw Jenny's family, still in the back of the crowd, safely behind the shooter and slowly moving behind the row of cars parked along the street. Through the cacophony, I heard Miriam yelling, "No, Tucker, no!" I saw Tucker running as fast as a half-Basset, half-St. Bernard can run toward the shooter, baying a sorrowful moan and looking like Dumbo about to take wing on the strength of his flapping ears. Motion at the corner below the bandstand caught my eye, and I saw Dolores struggling to get free of the Afghan covering her lap. My instincts were torn between trying to stop the advancing woman with the gun or jumping down to protect Dolores. Before I had to make the decision, a gun barrel appeared from under the Afghan, but the breech was tangled in the loose weave. "Uh-oh, uh-oh," was all I could say. While still tangled in the Afghan, Dolores' gun belched white smoke. The concussion echoed in the band shell. I heard lead pellets from the errant shot buzz past my ear like a swarm of bees. Above me, a piece of the band shell exploded as Dolores' shot blew splinters into the air, some of them raining down on the band. Until that point, remnants of the music had continued, but as the splinters rained down, the music died, and the musicians scrambled for the exits as the sulphurous white smoke drifted across the stage. In the background, I heard Miriam calling Tucker. The woman, racing through the crowd with the gun, became disoriented by the noise and smoke generated from the blunderbuss's black powder. She stopped at the edge of the bandshell, and Tucker bit the cuff of her jeans. The chaos, the white smoke, the band members scrambling from the chairs, and John Carr's human shield made it impossible for her to identify Sheila from all the other black-and-white-clad musicians. I jumped from the stage and tackled the woman as screams continued to emanate from the fleeing crowd. Fearing the discharge of another load of buckshot, I looked to the edge of the stage. Dolores freed the old short-barreled blunderbuss, once called a lap gun because they'd been carried for protection on the laps of people traveling in horse-drawn coaches. It had only one barrel and needed to be reloaded after each shot, so no one else was in peril from Dolores. The shooter was a hefty woman dressed in denim jeans and a T-shirt. Even with my running tackle, she hadn't gone down easily. Once she was on the ground, several spectators wrestled her gun away, and I held her until Len Rents took over. On the ground, and without her gun, the wind was out of her sails, and she sat on the ground, sobbing. "That bitch stole my pink ribbon," she blubbered. "She didn't sew that quilt. She bought it in Branson. She has no right. My quilt should be going to the state fair." With Len in control, I rushed for the stage to check on Sheila and anyone else who might have been hit by the gunshots or flying debris. I found a number of band members still on the stage, amazingly calm, mostly just taking in the crazy scene in the crowd, while others had sought shelter in the bandshell basement. I pulled myself on to the stage and found Sheila sitting in the back corner of the bandshell, sobbing into John Carr's shoulder. I threaded my way through the band members and knelt beside her. "Are you okay?" "I'm fine," she said with resignation. "The bullet missed me." I looked around and no one seemed to be bleeding or injured. "Is everyone okay?" I shouted. When no one responded, I asked, "Does anyone know where the bullet went?" "Dang it," I heard from the back of the bandshell. Pushing my way back through the toppled chairs, I found Brian Johnson poking his little finger through the bell of his tuba. "I just bought this. It's my E-flat four-valve Canstool. Why didn't I bring my Martin-renowned monster? I wouldn't care if there was a bullet hole in my Martin." I let out a sigh of relief, seeing the bullet lodged high in the back wall of the bandshell. "I'm sure it can be repaired," I said. "I'm just glad no one was hurt." Repair it? Brian asked, regaining his composure. Are you kidding? Can you imagine the stories I can tell every time I pull this out of the case? There's got to be a new tuba joke in here somewhere. But you can't play it like that. You don't know tubas, Brian replied. Like I told you before, a pinhole will make a trumpet useless, but a bullet hole won't affect a tuba. To demonstrate, he played a few bars of the Beer Barrel Polka. Jenny pushed her way through the musicians and pulled me close. After the hug, she pushed me back and said, You're a mess. I looked down and saw that my shirt was grass-stained and my bloody knee was poking through a hole in my pant leg. Hey, Doc, Brian said, it looks like you deserve another Purple Heart. I ignored him and went back to check on the rest of the band with Jenny in tow. We determined that no one was suffering from angina or any other ailments more severe than bruises from flying chairs and music stands. A few people had splinters in their hair from the ceiling. I felt a tug at my elbow and found myself facing Abby Finch's pimpled face. Mr. Rogers, are we going to play the last song? She asked, with a piccolo in her hand. I looked at the carnage on the stage, the mixture of overturned chairs, wood splinters, scattered sheet music, an abandoned trombone with a bent slide, and a couple broken folding chairs. I think everyone is too upset, I said. That comment was followed by grumbling from the band members, who were now picking up the carnage. The show must go on, someone shouted from the back row. I felt something hard in my hand and saw the piccolo case Jenny pressed into my palm. She leaned close and whispered, They're right. The show must go on. Don't disappoint Abby or your audience. Her tone of voice made it clear this was non-negotiable. I walked to the center of the carnage, and to the band members I said, Let's wrap up the set. Brian Johnson helped the band reassemble the jumbled chairs and music stands while I rounded up the rest of the band members. The band took their seats other than Sheila, who left the stage under John Carr's care. It took a few minutes to sort the music, but we got it all together. By the time everyone was settled, the shadows were getting long. I found the microphone and walked to the middle of the stage. I've never heard of a gunshot in a concert except for cannons in the 1812 overture, I said, garnering a few laughs from the crowd who had mostly found their way back to the park. I understand the band has played Stars and Stripes Forever as a closing song of the final concert for as long as anyone can remember. After some encouragement from the band, we've decided to play the finale despite the unexpected fireworks. The crowd cheered. With the downstroke, the brass section played Sousa's rousing opening, followed by the woodwinds. The adrenaline was still coursing through my system as the song flew by. When Abby stood, apparently expecting to play her piccolo while buried amidst the flutes, I took my piccolo from the music stand, stepped from the podium, took her hand and led her to the front of the stage where we waited for the beat where the piccolo solo started. We played flawlessly, and after the trill at the end of the solo, I took Abby's hand. We took a bow together and accepted the rousing applause from the audience. When she went back to the flutes, she was greeted with hugs and shoulder pats. At the end of the song, the band received a standing ovation as I stepped aside and joined in the applause. The ovation had been going for nearly a minute when Brian Johnson stepped forward with his holy tuba. He took the microphone, which hushed the crowd. In case you didn't know, Peter, Doc Rogers, was drafted just last week to conduct the band for the final two concerts after John Carr broke his foot. I think Peter has done an outstanding job of stepping into the job and whipping these two concerts together. Please give him a round of applause. Brian stepped aside and started clapping, and was quickly followed by the entire band and audience, who were still standing. I felt the redness creeping up my neck and looked at Dolores. She had a conspirator's grin on her face as she winked at me. Whistling Sousa, Chapter 28. The audience dispersed as the band broke down the chairs, hauling them from the stage to the band shell basement. I got a whiff of Honey Cavendish pipe smoke as I was helping carry chairs, and found Len Rents standing near the basement entrance. "Good job," he said, shaking my hand. "I'm a little relieved to have it all behind me. The last week has been nerve-wracking." "The concert was good, too," Len said, "but I was talking about taking Ashley Warren down while she was trying to shoot Sheila O'Keefe. Most people ran for cover at the sound of the gunshots. You jumped off the stage and tackled her. It seemed like the thing to do." "I'm sure you're curious about Ashley," Len said, inspecting his pipe. "She's a perennial winner of the county fair quilt competition. She always gets entry to the state fair with her quilt ribbon, so she'd already booked motel reservations in St. Paul for the entire 10 days. This year she came in fourth and is ineligible for the state fair. Ashley knows and respects Arlene Bartlett and Nancy Moore, but Sheila O'Keefe was a new competitor, and she started snooping around as soon as she saw the reserve champion ribbon on Sheila's quilt. When she found out Sheila hadn't been buying fabric at quilt shops, nor had she been seen at any of the quilting groups, she got suspicious. After online search for a quilt pattern featuring a bassoon, Ashley saw that a bassoon-themed quilt won the 2009 Missouri State Fair competition, and it was later sold at a fundraising auction in Branson, Missouri. It didn't take much research beyond that to find a photo of the winning Missouri quilt on the internet, and that was proof Sheila hadn't sewn the winning quilt. Ashley complained to everyone except the county fair judges, hoping someone would catch on and turn Sheila in without it looking like she was being a sore loser. When her subtle approach didn't work, she decided to scare Sheila off or kill her. Ashley isn't in the band. How did she get a peanut into Sheila's reed container on the county fair band shell? I asked. She gave a 4-H kid a buck to do it. She told him she was playing a practical joke on her friend, the bassoon player. I guess Ashley overheard Sheila turn down some nuts at a bar one night, explaining that she has an allergy, and Ashley filed that tidbit away until Sheila's quilt took her reserve champion ribbon at the fair. Why would Sheila buy an award-winning quilt and enter it in the county fair competition? I asked. Sheila wrote a loan for Robbie, Ashley's husband, which allowed him to quit his railroad job and open a taxidermy business. Ashley suspected there had been something going on between Robbie and Sheila, but when the business started out very slowly and they had no health insurance, Ashley called the bank and tried to get them to restructure the loan, threatening to expose what she saw as Sheila's shady role in making the loan. In the end, there had been nothing between Sheila and Robbie, but the bank wanted to squelch any bad publicity, so they rewrote the loan at almost zero interest, and Sheila got a black mark from the bank. I guess entering the quilt in the fair was her way of getting back at Ashley, who took great pride in getting her quilt to the state fair competition. Noise behind us caused Len to look over my shoulder. Jeremy and Howard were lugging a stack of lawn chairs while Jeremy was chattering away about the night I'd thrown him to the floor last spring after Dolores tried to shoot a rabbit. "I'm telling you, Grandpa, it was just like that. Peter gets me on the floor and he races toward the sound of the gunfire. It's like he has a death wish or something." The story ended just as they reached us and Jenny's dad set down his stack of chairs. He took my right hand in both hands. "Jeremy, I'm pretty sure Peter doesn't have a death wish. He's just one of those extraordinary people who is more concerned about the safety of others than his own safety. The military pins medals on their chests, and the rest of us call them heroes. I stood there speechless, shaking hands as I broke into a sweat and flashed back to a dusty Iraq military compound. A dozen of us had been pulled forward after a flag-raising ceremony, and a Marine Corps colonel was walking down the row, pinning purple hearts on our chests and shaking hands. I could feel the burning stitches that ran inside my bicep where the Iraqi bullet had grazed my arm, and I could hear the flag snapping in the hot desert wind. I was pulled away from the flashback when Jenny pushed her way between us and gave me a hug. Then I heard the clinking of bangles that always preceded my mother's arrival. Mother cut in on Jenny and hugged me while Jenny's mother, Barbara, stood aside, prim, proper, and pressed. Barbara called and told me you were directing the band again tonight. I'm afraid I was a little late, but I saw you jump from the stage to wrestle that crazy woman to the ground, and I heard the last song. I told the people standing around us, you were my son. You made me proud. In my entire life, I couldn't remember my mother ever saying those words. Ignoring Jenny, Mother linked her arm in mine and said, come on, I'm buying you supper. I stood still, and she asked, what's wrong? The rest of the family is joining us, too. I stepped away from Mother and gave Barbara a hug, which she actually returned. I took Barbara's hand and I led her to Mother. You two should get to know each other better. Of course we should, Mother announced, grabbing Barbara and Jenny's hands. Len pulled on my sleeve and, in an outdoor voice, asked, when are you buying Jenny a diamond? He pushed me toward the family before I could answer. With my mouth agape, I found the three women staring at me. Words escaped me. Mother, seeing the look on my face, took charge. She let go of Jenny's hand and started pulling at her chubby fingers with her right hand. After a substantial effort that garnered the attention of Jenny's entire family, she pulled a ring free. Here, she said, handing me a gold ring with a series of small diamonds embedded across the crest. She looked at me expectantly and finally said, being rather free-spirited in our youth, your father and I never had a formal engagement. We lived together while he went to law school. When we married, he had a job at a law firm, and we suddenly had money. He gave me this lovely ring he called my engagement ring. I stared at the ring, having seen it on Mother's finger for decades, but never really looking at it before. I looked up and saw her eyes clouded with tears. At this point, the tradition is that you would get down on one knee, she said, before she lost her voice and flipped a hand at me, telling me to get on with it. I turned to Jenny, who was wide-eyed and as dumbfounded as I. I looked down at my torn, grass-stained pants and searched for words. I wasn't opposed to proposing to Jenny. I was just unprepared to ask her at that moment, with all of our family and others watching. For 1 second, I had a terrible feeling of dread that she might say no. The ring was jerked from my fingers, and Jeremy turned to Jenny. Mom, he wants you to marry him. Will you say yes so he can get something to eat? I'm starving. He lifted her hand and jammed the ring on her middle finger, where it stuck at her knuckle. As Jeremy stepped aside, Jenny lifted her hand and examined the ring, then looked at me with tears filling her blue eyes. I was still speechless, but I managed to nod. Jenny slipped the ring from her middle finger and slid it on her ring finger. She stared at it for what seemed like minutes before lunging at me, nearly knocking me to the ground. Yes, she whispered in my ear as we hugged. Acknowledgements. In any fictional endeavor, there is the part my golfing buddy, Vern Redenbaugh, calls making up stuff, where I draw inspiration from a number of sources. As with Whistling Pines, I thank Brian Johnson, a resident of Two Harbors who really is a tubist in the Two Harbors City Band, and several people he provided as contacts who gave me great background on Two Harbors and the band. Among those contacts are Albie, who may have been lost in history but has been revived and enhanced here. John Carr is one of the band directors, and the use of him as the fictional band director is by no means meant to diminish his profound musical abilities, including being able to fill in on a number of instruments when required. I use Brian, Albie, and John as characters with my profound thanks for their input and their willingness to provide color to the story. I must add that Brian is extremely colorful in his own right and has supplied most of the tuba jokes. Believe me, I too groaned the first time I read each of them. Phyllis Comstock, a remarkable chemist, musician, and dear friend, was kind enough to provide her clarinetist viewpoint of the dynamics and politics of an orchestra. The new Whistling Pines characters, Nancy Helmbrecht, the new director, and Barbie Burke, the expert florist in the dining room, are friends from Dandelion Floral and Gifts in Mora, Minnesota, who have generously supported me and who asked to be characters in one of my books. Here you are. Thanks to Arlene Bartlett and Nancy Moore, quilters extraordinaire, who helped me understand the process, time, talent, and commitment required to complete a quilt. Arlene's quilt was the grand champion at the Carleton County Fair in 2012. It was a kaleidoscope with incredible colors and patterns, all sewn together from tiny pieces of fabric with love and care. Beyond quilting, Nancy and Larry Moore provide me with inspiration and constant encouragement. I really couldn't have completed this book without the aid and encouragement of Franny Brozo. It was Franny who suggested the title Whistling Sousa. After reading the manuscript, she told me the book left her walking the house Whistling Sousa. Thanks to editor Pat Morris, who asked numerous questions about the plot, the characters, and the situations, making me think them through and rewrite them until they were sharp and clean. I have to credit my mother-in-law, Hildur Lund, my uncle Frank Hovey, my parents, George and Lorraine Hovey, and other senior citizens who provided color, smiles, and stories. Through the efforts of one of my readers, Mike Mercer, I was introduced to retired Chief William Finney of the St. Paul Police Department. The chief provided me with incidents from his long career that had us laughing, some of which are used fictionally in this book. Thanks, Chief. Thanks also to Dennis Arnold, who continues to provide input, color, and stories to every one of my books. He and his wife Barb are dear friends who help keep our spirits up when our house in Moose Lake, Minnesota was inundated with 3 feet of water in the Duluth flood of 2012. As always, thanks to my wife Julie, who nursed me through recovery from back surgery while I wrote this book, and who is the first proofreader of each book. In her role as stoic Scandinavian, she makes sure I stay grounded and humble. The past 2 weeks' episodes of this program can be listened to from the ktwh.org website. Simply click on Literally from the North Shore from the program's drop-down menu found at the top of the homepage to listen to the archived shows.